From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Once again, the American labor movement is in crisis. It looks like there's going to be a split. Is this going to solve the problem? I don't think so.
Will the AFL-CIO split as the nation's largest labor organization heads to its convention in Chicago? We host a debate on the future of organized labor. Then the great American job scam, corporate tax dodging, and the myth of job creation. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez. British authorities are characterizing Thursday's small explosions in the London Underground system a failed attempt to replicate the July 7th bombings. They say the attackers tried and failed to detonate explosive devices at three underground stations and on a double-decker bus 2 weeks to the day after more than 50 people were killed in coordinated bombings. As police and other law enforcement hunt for clues and suspects, one man was shot dead at the Stockwell Underground station by armed plainclothes police officers. It's unclear why he was shot, but one eyewitness told the BBC the man was wearing what he called a bomb belt with wires coming out. The BBC is also reporting armed police surrounded a mosque in East London that was evacuated after a bomb scare. Police say they're now hunting four would-be bombers. The British authorities say the bombers fled after detonators went off, causing small blasts, but failed to detonate the bombs themselves. The Guardian newspaper reports that at least one of the bombs was being carried on an underground train in a rucksack by a man who shouted in surprise when it failed fully to explode. The paper says the man appears to have then vanished in the scenes of panic and confusion that followed. A second device was allegedly carried onto the tube by a man who dodged fellow passengers and fled when its detonator apparently went off. It's believed police have recovered four viable bombs, one from each of the four scenes. Three of these were of a similar size. One was smaller. One's believed to have contained nails. They were all in rucksacks, and police say they bore similarities to those used by the four suicide bombers in the July 7th attacks. This is Prime Minister Tony Blair speaking Thursday, shortly after the underground stations were evacuated.
We can't minimize incidents such as this because they obviously have been serious in the four different places, as we know. I think all I'd like to say is this, that we know why these things are done. They're done to scare people and to frighten them, to make them anxious and worried. Fortunately, in this instance, there appear to have been no casualties. The police have done their very best, and the security services too, in the situation. And I think we've just got to react calmly.
That was British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Shortly after the scare in London Thursday, New York City's police commissioner announced the NYPD will begin random searches of bags and packages carried by people entering city subways. Passengers carrying bags will allegedly be selected at random before they pass through turnstiles. Police officials say those who refuse to be searched won't be allowed to ride. If an officer looking for explosives finds some other form of contraband, police say the person would be subject to arrest. The announcement drew immediate fire from civil liberties groups. The New York Civil Liberties Union said the searches violate basic rights. The group's executive director, Donna Lieberman, said, quote, "The NYPD can and should investigate any suspicious activity, but the Fourth Amendment prohibits police from conducting searches where there's no suspicion of criminal activity." Similar types of random searches of subway passengers have prompted criticism from civil liberties groups in other cities, and in some cases have been challenged in court. On Capitol Hill, the House of Representatives renewed the USA Patriot Act Thursday, voting mostly along party lines to make permanent the government's unprecedented powers. 16 provisions of the 2001 law, pushed through in the aftermath of September 11th, are due to expire at the end of the year unless renewed by Congress. President Bush has repeatedly called on lawmakers to make the entire law permanent. Republicans repeatedly argued throughout the 11-hour debate that the latest explosions in London show how urgent and important it is to renew the law. Republicans also added a new provision to apply the federal death penalty for so-called terrorist offenses that result in death, and another establishing a new crime of narco-terrorism to punish people using drug profits to aid terrorism. These offenders will now face 20-year minimum prison sentences. The Senate Judiciary Committee voted unanimously to recommend its own version of the act Thursday, which included only 4-year renewals of these two clauses. The full Senate's expected to take take its bill up in the fall. This news from Texas. Hundreds of pastors for peace volunteers preparing to deliver a massive shipment of humanitarian aid to Cuba have been barred at the U.S.-Mexico border and could be held there for days. Commerce Department officials are saying they'll search every vehicle in the caravan and every item of humanitarian aid, which hasn't been done for years, and they'll only allow what Washington deems licensable goods to be allowed to cross into Mexico. Border agents are threatening to tow the caravan's vehicles and have already seized some aid donations, including computers. Some volunteers are walking across the U.S.-Mexico border carrying wheelchairs, crutches, and other medical supplies. Others are holding a protest at the border. There are 130 U.S. citizens traveling with the delegation, as well as a truck and two small cars. They're attempting to deliver 140 tons of aid. The Bush administration tightened restrictions against Cuba in 2004 and is using Homeland Security funds to investigate those suspected of travel to the island. The Palestinian envoy to the United Nations charged Thursday that Israel's using its planned withdrawal from Gaza to divert attention from a continued expansion of its West Bank settlements and an extension of its massive wall around Jerusalem. In front of the UN Security Council, Samir Barghouti called on Israel to freeze all settlement activity and dismantle settlement outposts erected since March 2001. But Israeli UN Ambassador Dan Gillerman urged council members to focus on the Gaza withdrawal and accused the Palestinian envoy of distorting the facts. Arab nations requested the council debate to put fresh pressure on the UN a year after an advisory opinion of the World Court concluded that what the Israeli government calls the fence and others call the apartheid wall was illegal. Israel has said it's ignoring the court's ruling. The Iraqi government released a video of deposed President Saddam Hussein appearing before a judge. In the video, broadcast on Al Arabiya TV, Saddam blasts Iraq's new government and protests his lack of access to a lawyer. Earlier this week, the Iraqi Special Tribunal brought its first charges against Saddam. No trial date has been set. The Bush administration has been bragging that there will be a new constitution in Iraq by mid-August, but that now seems very unlikely. All the Sunni members of Iraq's Constitution Drafting Committee have suspended their membership in the committee and are boycotting its meetings. According to Iraq expert Juan Cole, they're protesting the clerical Shiite head of the committee keeps giving interviews in which he maintains that the constitution will be ready by August 1st, when in fact the Sunnis don't even accept that first sentence of the current draft. The Sunnis are also demanding an international investigation into the killing of three Sunni members of the committee Tuesday. Meanwhile, the Kurds presented the Constitution Committee with a new map of their proposed state of Kurdistan, which expands its borders south of previous prototypes. They're demanding this map be incorporated into the new constitution. The Pentagon has confirmed 52 prisoners at the prison camp at Guantanamo are staging a hunger strike in protest of their detention and treatment. The military says the men have refused 9 consecutive meals over 3 days. This comes after 2 recently released prisoners alleged that 180 men were on hunger strike. Syria is charging its border troops had been fired on by U.S. and Iraqi forces and accused Washington, London, and Baghdad of lack of cooperation in preventing resistance fighters from crossing the border into Iraq. The U.S. military in Iraq has launched several operations against insurgents near the Iraqi border with Syria in the past few months. The Sudanese government was forced to apologize to U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice yesterday after a series of scuffles between her entourage and Sudanese security. Officials and reporters traveling with Rice to Khartoum were initially prevented from entering the compound of the president, Omar Hassan al-Bashir. After they were allowed in, there were further bouts of shouting and shoving. Witnesses say NBC reporter Andrea Mitchell was manhandled after attempting to question Bashir. Sudan's foreign minister quickly apologized to Rice. The Bloomberg News Agency is reporting 2 figures at the center of the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame may have intentionally misled investigators. The agency says President Bush's senior advisor, Karl Rove, and Dick Cheney's chief of staff, Scooter Libby, gave accounts to the special prosecutor about how reporters told them the identity of a CIA agent that are at odds with what reporters have said. Libby told Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald that he first learned Plame's identity from NBC News reporter Tim Russert. Bloomberg says Russert has testified before a federal grand jury that he didn't tell Libby of Plame's identity. Rove, meanwhile, told Fitzgerald he first learned the identity of the CIA agent from syndicated columnist Robert Novak. But Bloomberg cites a source saying that Novak has given a different version to the special prosecutor. Fitzgerald's investigating whether Libby, Rove, or other administration officials made false statements during the course of the investigation. Another pirate radio station has been raided by the FCC. Thursday morning at around 11 a.m., Free Radio San Diego was reportedly raided by a number of FCC agents with marshals. Staffers at the station say no one was present at the location. They charge the FCC broke the locks on their doors, entered by force, took their equipment, and left. They left a warrant behind. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of you listening in on broadcast land and over the Internet. Well, the organized labor movement brought American workers the 40-hour week, pensions, health care, and most of the basic rights enjoyed on the job today. From a high point of 22.8 million union members in 1978, the ranks of organized labor have now dwindled to 15.5 million this year. Now, with less bargaining power and a deindustrialized service-based economy, the labor movement is in the throes of a debate over how to build for the future.
The venerable American Federation of Labor may face the largest rupture in its history next week. In March, five of the AFL-CIO's largest affiliate unions criticized the leadership of Federation President John Sweeney. Together, the service employees, Teamsters, United Food and Commercial Workers, laborers, and Unite Here represent between 35% and 40% of the AFL's membership, and most of their workers are in rapidly expanding service sectors where low-wage immigrant workers of color have won some hard-fought union battles in recent years. Last month, the five unions launched the Change to Win Coalition, which is threatening to split from the AFL-CIO if their demands aren't met at the annual convention next week in Chicago.
The Change to Win platform revolves around the premise that the AFL should direct more resources towards organizing new workers than lobbying Washington politicians, and that it should centralize into bigger unions. But the AFL leadership charges that effective organizing can't happen without a more favorable political climate, which requires leverage in Washington. Meanwhile, other labor activists questioned whether renewed organizing could even be successful unless current union members are mobilized and unions democratize their own structures.
Today, we host a roundtable on the potential split in the AFL-CIO and the future of the labor movement. We're joined on the phone from Chicago by Chris Chafee, Chief of Staff of Unite Here, one of the Change to Win Coalition members. Also in Chicago is Karen Ackerman, Political Director of the AFL-CIO. Here in New York, co-founder of the rank-and-file newsletter Labor Notes, we're joined by Kim Moody. He's author of Workers in a Lean World, Unions in the International Economy. And we welcome you all to Democracy Now! Why don't we begin with Karen Ackerman? You and Chris Chafee are in Chicago for the annual convention. Talk about what's at stake here.
Well, the convention will really take, really engage, I think, the entire labor movement in a rigorous debate like we've been having leading up to the convention. A rigorous debate as to how to strengthen and move the labor movement forward and how best to represent workers in this country. And I think, you know, that debate is a good debate to have. I think that the, you know, what's, there's a lot at stake, obviously. There's, you know, we're hoping that the result of this convention will be a stronger labor movement that has a clearer unity of purpose, and that is that there are sort of twin goals here of equal importance. One is to strengthen the union's commitment to organize workers, and there's no question that that is absolutely a cornerstone of what we hope to achieve. But the other side of that is to strengthen the commitment to expand union members' engagement in the political process, and that you cannot separate those twin goals, and that the labor movement, in order to really to strengthen in its representation of workers in this country, has to address both those goals.
I'd like to ask Chris Chafe. Clearly, your group feels that the crisis in American labor today is at such a level that you must actually consider splitting away unless you can get some changes. What made you come to that conclusion? And also, how do you answer those who say that the major theme of organized labor solidarity is being ruptured through this process of contemplating splitting?
Well, first, thank you for letting me be on the show this morning. I think that we got to this point because we are 10 years into the Sweeney administration, and we continue to see really horrendous conditions persist for American workers. We feel like within each of our unions in the Change to Win Coalition, which also includes the Carpenters Union, and we'll be adding more unions in the days to come, we have each gone through an experience, either through the deindustrialization of the economy or other forces, that has made all of our unions fundamentally go through a change and focus more of our resources towards organizing and really structure the way we engage all of our work completely differently. For example, at Unite Here, we spend 43% of our budget on organizing, and almost all of our political program is tooled to support organizing campaigns. The same is true with different numbers, with a number of the partners in Change to Win. And so from our own experiences in our own unions of enduring some tough, tough battles internally to change our own organizations, we realize that the same has to be done throughout the AFL-CIO if we're going to have any hope of rebuilding the labor movement and gaining real strength for workers. So that's the foundation of what we're doing here.
What about this whole issue of labor solidarity?
Well, I think, unfortunately, the labor movement is already bitterly divided. We have unions currently in the current AFL-CIO situation who are raiding each other. We have unions that are organizing in each other's jurisdiction. We have no clear enforcement mechanism that is helping clarify for unions who they should and should not organize. We're fighting each other. So to talk about solidarity in the current context is a little bit misleading because we really don't have any clear purpose and rules, and that's been a lot of what the Change to Win program has been about, creating a much clearer power at the center of the labor movement through the AFL-CIO that gives us a blueprint for organizing and change.
Kim Moody, your author of Workers in a Lean World, looking at this from the outside, talk about what's at stake right now. Can you talk about your characterization of both sides and what this means for the greater worker movement in this country?
Yes. Okay. First of all, thanks for having me here. Appreciate that. Well, the outside, I'm a union member. I belong to two locals of the AFT. I think what's at stake here is the future of the labor movement, but I have a somewhat different take on it. If you think about the AFL-CIO and the decline in union density in the United States, it's kind of an odd coincidence that the year the AFL-CIO was founded, 1955, was the high point, and it's been downhill ever since.
So this is the 50th anniversary?
This is. December will be the 50th anniversary. I think the foundation of the AFL-CIO left a lot of problems unresolved. To me, the question is not just organizing in the sense of putting more money and more professional staff in the field or something like that, rebates. Core jurisdiction, this is a good idea, should have been doing that for a long time.
But what's core jurisdiction?
Core jurisdiction is what the Change to Win Coalition is talking about. The union should be organizing, not the UAW shouldn't be organizing graduate students. It should be organizing automobile workers in the South, for example. The SEIU organizes healthcare workers. This is a good thing. I'm all for this. But I think what is unresolved here is one of the basic problems labor has had for a long time, which is the relationship between leaders and members. That is, the leaders have for decades now isolated and insulated themselves from the members. The members are not motivated, not mobilized, except very occasionally. And that if you're going to have a kind of upsurge. Unions don't grow incrementally. They grow in upsurges. And if you're going to have this, it's going to take the activation of, if not the whole membership, at least the activist layer of the labor movement, to get out there and to do this. Workers organize workers. That's the way labor has always grown traditionally. Our unions, unfortunately, have become, and long ago, bureaucratic organizations, top-down organizations. The lesson I draw from the failure of the Sweeney era is that top-down reform basically doesn't work. That, and I don't think that the kind of recipe that's coming from the Change to Win Coalition, and what I mean by that is things like the SEIU's mega locals or the Carpenters regional mega organizations that we now have so-called locals, you can't even really call them that, in the SEIU, the 32BJ runs from New York to Philadelphia, 1199, similarly, I could give you many more examples. This is an administrative approach to the problem of labor, and it seems to me that it didn't work for Sweeney, and it's not going to work for the Change to Win Coalition. The debate is good. If there's competition that isn't rating, that could be positive. But it seems to me there has to be a fundamental change in the relationship between leaders and members.
We're going to talk more about that when we come back from our break. Our guests, Kim Moody, author of Workers in a Lean World, Chris Chafe, chief of staff of Unite Here, and Karen Ackerman, political director of the AFL-CIO. We're talking about the future of labor in this country. Stay with us.
There is power in a factory, power in the land, power in the hand of the worker. But it all amounts to nothing if together we don't stand. There is power in a union. Now the lessons of the past were all learned with workers' blood. The mistakes of the bosses we must pay for. From the cities and the farmlands to trenches full of mud. War has always been the boss's way, sir. The union forever defending our rights. Down with the blacklegged workers, unite. With our brothers and our sisters, together we will stand. There is power in a union. Now I long for the morning that they realise brutality and unjust laws cannot defeat us. Who'll defend the workers who cannot organise when the bosses send their lackeys out to cheat us? Money speaks for money.
Billy Bragg, there's power in a union here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 350 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM stations, on PBS and public access TV stations, as well as both TV satellite networks. On Dish Network, we're on channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV on channel 375. We are video and audio streaming at Democracy Now! We're podcasting there as well. Closed caption for people who are deaf and hard of hearing, and our headlines are in Spanish, both audio and transcript, at our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're talking about the future of labor with this opening of the AFL-CIO convention in Chicago. Kim Moody is with us in New York, author of Workers in a Lean World. Chris Chafe, chief of staff at Unite Here, and Karen Ackerman, political director of the AFL-CIO, are both in Chicago at the convention. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
I'd like to get back to Karen Ackerman for a moment. Karen, no one doubts who knows the trajectory of the labor movement that under John Sweeney there has been progress compared to previous administrations in the AFL, and a lot of changes in political direction that are positive. But Sweeney came in 10 years ago saying that he was going to revitalize the labor movement, saying that he was going to be a transitional figure only in for one term. He's now been in for 10 years and is seeking re-election again. Essentially, much of the revitalization that he promised has not occurred. Why should other unions support the direction that he is proposing to go in a new administration or a new term?
Yeah, I'd like to address some of the things that the other speakers have said along with your question, Juan. I think the question of unity is a really important question. And you know, Chris mentioned you know, talked about that the labor movement is disunified, and that, you know, that sort of, and I've heard this, that some unions breaking off and leaving the AFL-CIO is not disunifying because AFL-CIO is already disunified. That really speaks to, I think, a real critical issue here. And that is that there are many differences in the labor movement. There's no question the labor movement is a complicated institution. It represents, you know, 57 different unions with different industries, different kinds of workers, different histories, different cultures. And the AFL-CIO is the umbrella organization that, people choose to belong to. And choose to affiliate on a local level as well, and some choose not to affiliate on a local level. So it's a complicated institution that at this point is going through what I think is a healthy discussion. So, yes, there are rating situations. Yes, there are is intense debate about the direction of the labor movement. But to me, that does not justify leaving the labor movement, because then you have true disunity. And to me, it sounds like what we used to hear, and that is you have to destroy the village in order to save it. I don't think that solves anything. My fear is if that some unions leave, then the raiding will get more intense. It will exacerbate hostilities, and that the labor movement will turn inward against itself, when in fact we're being attacked from the outside. We're being attacked and attempted to be dismantled by the right wing in this country, by the Bush administration and the corporate forces. And we need an organization that that stays together and fights together and engages members to fight. I think addressing what Kim Moody said is that I think that the and my area is the political program. I think for the last 10 years, since the Sweeney administration came in, the whole concept of how we do, and I'll speak to the political program, the whole way we do concept is to do politics in this country from the labor movement's point of view has to change. And that is we no longer accepted the idea that the political program was, you know, getting members out to vote by telling them who to vote for in the last month before the election and campaign contributions to candidates. We changed the culture, I think, of the labor movement from that kind of top-down culture to an acceptance, a real unity of acceptance of all the unions, that the political program had to engage union members at the workplace where the union is and get information to union members about the issues they care about, issues of economic security, and encourage union members to get engaged in the political process and to fight back. This is all about fighting the forces that are out to dismantle the living standards of workers. And I think that's been our success, that our approach has always been for the last 10 years. Reach out to union members, engage them, train folks to be spokespeople in political skills, and organize from the bottom up. And that's our approach with organizing as well. So
and to get
I think
back,
there have been major
to,
changes in the last 10 years.
But then to get back to the question of the ultimate question is the labor movement growing or declining, and why should the Sweeney program continue to be supported?
Well, there's no question that unions are losing members. There's no question about that, and that the labor movement has to focus on organizing as well as changing the environment in this country politically. But and that has been the debate, and it's been promoted by a number of the Change to Win unions, and that's a good thing. And that debate has to continue. The proposal by the Sweeney administration on rebates sets the bar higher for unions than the Change to Win unions. The administration, the Sweeney's administration proposal, says that unions, in order to get a rebate to organize, unions have to spend 30% of their own dues money to organize. So it sets the bar higher, and it challenges unions to spend more of their resources organizing, and in fact, it will raise more money from unions to organize. Our commitment is absolutely to create an environment in this country where workers can organize and also change the culture in the unions to promote more organizing. And that's where organizing comes from.
Yeah, I'd like to go back to Chris Che for a second and ask him. Chris, the criticism of the reform group, the Change to Win group, that some people have raised is that you are focusing almost all on structural remedies for the labor movement and not dealing with the some of the substantive issues of the fact, as Kim Moody says, this the problems of some of the political direction of some of these unions that already exist, the lack of a clear analysis of the of how you build a progressive the content of the labor movement, how you build a progressive labor movement, especially in this country, the biggest capitalist empire in the history of the world.
Well, okay. I think that the if you were to ask any progressive political force in the country to name who the most progressive and supportive and engaged unions are on a broad level of progressive issues, ranging from wages, community strength, benefits, worker safety, you name it, I think that almost anyone's list, at the top of that list, is going to be the Change to Win unions. So I think that that our credential and our capacity to continue to lead in those avenues is unquestionable. So I think that, and I want to go back to something that Kim said. You know, if you look at it from a perspective of how are the members engaged, he's right. And the fact is that our union has learned that lesson across the years, that in fact our best resources are our membership, the core of who does all of the organizing for us across the country, whether it's organizing tribal gaming workers in California or hotel workers outside of JFK Airport, or laundry workers in Atlantic City. That's our members. That's rank and file union leaders who know that unless they do the organizing themselves in the sectors and the industries where they live and work, that their own conditions are never going to improve. So I would agree completely that we have to have a membership-based organization. I can only speak to one other of our partners, but SEIU. If you look at SEIU and their political program, I think Karen would agree that there is no union that has involved more members than SEIU in a political operation. And if you look at who has been the cornerstone of the successes of the Sweeney political operation that Karen and others have led for the last 10 years, the Change to Win unions are really at least 60-70% of who's been there in the streets making things happen. There's no doubt that we've had significant gains in the political power of the labor movement in terms of centralizing our program, but we continue to lose elections, and the reason we continue to lose elections is there aren't enough union members. And if we don't figure out how to structurally change the AFL and how to create a different kind of culture around organizing in all of our unions, and this is far bigger than John Sweeney, we're not going to be able to have any major political victories, and we can throw as much money as we want to at trying to elect Democrats, but they are not going to be the savior here. Organizing is the way we're going to have more power, and our whole program has been focused on that. I think almost all of the working for Winning for Working Families program that the AFL's put out is draws from the Change to Win ideas, and so they've moved towards our proposals, and that's an important good step in the right direction. But we're not done, and it's got to go beyond rhetoric.
Yeah, I'd like to bring Kim Moody in. Your response to what you've heard from both Karen Ackerman and Chris Chafe.
Well, I think, first of all, our movement has a terrible problem with political coherence. We don't have political coherence. We don't have our own political movement. We're dependent on the Democrats, as Chris pointed out, and they don't seem to care very much anymore, if they ever did. So I think that's a problem. You know, in terms of, well, the change The Change to Win Coalition, most progressive unions, some yes, but the Teamsters, the Carpenters, I don't think so. I think there's a problem on both sides with this. We are getting better at mobilizing people at election time, but in getting our own politics across to our own members, over a third of them, didn't vote the way we would have liked, or the way most labor leaders would have liked. So we still have an enormous problem there. I want to say something about solidarity. Solidarity is not a matter of affiliation. Solidarity is a matter of action. And the problem we have there is that we can count over and over again the number of organizing drives, strikes, campaigns for better contracts that go down to defeat because there isn't really any active solidarity. People from other unions are not showing up, are not helping each other. We saw the UFCW lose this strike in Southern California of grocery workers when they didn't need to lose, actually pulled down a picket line that was being recognized by the Teamsters. Solidarity has to be an active thing done in practice, not just a matter of affiliation.
Karen, by Sunday we'll know whether the last-minute negotiations can stave off a split. What would be the impact on the AFL-CIO of losing one-third of the members and along with their dues, and what kind of impact would that have on the ability of the AFL-CIO to continue to conduct its work? And is there any hope of being able to get some kind of a settlement that would be amenable to both sides?
Well, I am hopeful that's possible, Juan. I feel very strongly that the comments that Chris made about change and moving forward and helping unions to commit to organize and the remarkable work that a number of the Change to Win unions have done in the last number of years, particularly in the political arena, that change continues only when you're in the game and when you're at the table. And so my hope is that, and there has been a lot of movement from a number of the unions embracing some of the aspects of the Change to Win program. So there's been a tremendous amount of movement, tremendous amount of debate.
Well, let's ask Chris Chafe. Do you think you'll be leaving by Sunday night?
I think we have a couple of substantive issues that have to get resolved, and if they're not, then we probably will leave on Sunday.
Well, we'll certainly continue to follow this story. We want to thank you all for being with us. Chris Chafe, Chief of Staff at Unite Here, Karen Ackerman, Political Director of the AFL-CIO. Major events taking place this weekend at the National Convention of the AFL-CIO, and Kim Moody, author of Workers in a Lean World. Thanks very much all for being with us. When we come back from our break, we'll be looking at the Great American Job Scam, corporate tax dodging, and the myth of job creation. Stay with us.
Now I'm a union man, amazed at what I am. I say what I think, that the company stinks. Yes, I'm a union man. When we meet in the local hall, I'll be voting with a hell of a shout. It's out, brothers, out. And the rise of the factories fall.
Oh, you don't get me, I'm part of the union. You don't get me, I'm part of the union. You don't get me, I'm part of the union. Till the day I die. Till the day I die.
As a union man, I'm wise to the lies of the company spies, and I don't get fooled by the factory rules, cause I always read between the lines, and I always get my way if I strike for higher pay. When I show my card to the Scotland Yard, and this is what I say, we
Straub's Part of the Union here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. What do Walmart, Dell, Fidelity Investments, and Boeing have in common? They're all part of a $50 billion a year scam in which corporations play states and cities against each other to win hefty taxpayer subsidies in the name of job creation. But do they provide more jobs, higher wages, or improve living standards? A new book says no. We're joined by Greg LeRoy, author of The Great American Job Scam, Corporate Tax Dodging, and the Myth of Job Creation. He's director of the nonprofit Good Jobs First. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy. Thanks, Juan.
It's great to have you in our Washington studio. Why don't you lay out the premise of your book?
Sure. As you mentioned, it's a $50 billion a year scam. That's total spending by states and cities in the name of jobs. The average state subsidizes jobs more than 30 different ways now, and those subsidies are often granted by local bodies of government. The trouble is, nobody's watching the store in too many cases. Companies get huge subsidies, in many cases, to do exactly what they were going to do anyway, to go where they wanted to go, to lay off people or to outsource or to pay poverty wages or bust a union or privatize work anyway. And governments don't even enforce the promises made originally when companies say they're going to create X number of jobs or create X amount of additional tax revenue. So taxpayers are often losing twice or three times by losing jobs, not getting as much tax revenue as they promised, and losing tax revenue that could be really used to create good jobs through other means.
Well, how has it gotten to this stage, Greg? Well, many of us are familiar with the usual reports. X company was offered these job incentives because they were considering leaving to move somewhere else. And as a result of the job incentives, not only will the X number of jobs be created, but there will be multiplier effects that will create other jobs. But no one ever checks back 5 years later or 10 years later to find out what actually happened, right?
Yes, yeah, certainly the whole job blackmail dynamic you just described there is epidemic in many parts of the country. It's especially true in New York City, where dozens of companies, media companies, financial companies, insurance companies, have threatened to leave the city and shaken down the city for 8- and 9-figure packages by threatening to run away to places like Jersey City or Greenwich, Connecticut. The trouble is, when you go back and read the fine print of the contracts written by the city, giving the big tax breaks to allegedly retain the companies, you find that the contracts are Swiss cheese, that they give the company lots of latitude to lay people off before triggering any kind of penalties. And the city isn't doing a good job monitoring, has historically not done a good job monitoring the outcomes. But it's hardly unique to New York City. Companies like Raytheon did it to Massachusetts, ConAgra did it to Nebraska, Sears did it to Illinois. And then there's other dynamics, too, you know, pirating jobs with taxpayer money or moving jobs around with taxpayer money, like the case of Dell getting a massive package from the state of North Carolina, a package that could approach $300 million for a facility that will only cost about $100 million. The system has grown up over 50 years. There's a whole industry of site location consultants who specialize in keeping the process secret. At its core, the problem is that the corporate decision-making process really is a black box. We're not allowed to really understand how companies make their decision. Public officials are kept out of the process. They're deliberately kept in the dark so that public officials cannot cooperate in the interest of taxpayers. Governors cannot cooperate. Mayors cannot cooperate. And therefore, governments are played against each other. They're whipsawed. And we're all taken to the cleaners as taxpayers.
Greg LeRoy, can you talk about Walmart and the examples of how it has benefited by this, well, what you call the Great American Job Scam?
Sure. Taxpayers subsidize Walmart at least two different ways, both through the front door and through the back door. And the front door, I mean bricks and mortar subsidies. We at Good Jobs First last year identified more than $1 billion of bricks and mortar subsidies given to Walmart stores and warehouses. Loans, grants, cheap land, infrastructure, so-called tax increment financing, other training grants, things like that. And then in the back door, other sources, including congressional U.S. staff in the U.S. House of Representatives, have identified massive subsidies given to Walmart employees through safety net programs, that is Medicaid, children's health insurance, free school lunches, Section 8 housing assistance, earned income tax credits, given to workers at Walmart and their family because the company pays poverty wages. So we as taxpayers are subsidizing the company heavily, coming and going.
What kind of examples have you uncovered of communities who successfully resisted these kinds of efforts or that actually held companies accountable for their promises?
Well, that's the exciting part of the movement today. At the grassroots level, both at the state and local level, a growing number of groups are fighting back, demanding accountability. 12 states now have some form of annual company-specific disclosure, states like Minnesota and Maine and Illinois and Washington State coming online soon, where so that taxpayers can see the costs and benefits of every deal. And when that happens, a lot of bad deals tend to go away. That's what history teaches us. A number of states and cities are enacting what are called clawbacks, literally money-back guarantee language, to hold companies accountable and saying, if you fall short on job creation, we get some of our money back. More than 40 states and more than 40 cities around the country are attaching wage standards to their subsidies, saying to Walmart or anybody else, if you get a subsidy from us, you've got to pay a better wage, a living wage. The jobs have to be full-time. They have to have health care. That's becoming a very common standard attached to subsidies. And then at the local level, you've got very exciting project-specific campaigns like those, especially led by the Los Angeles Alliance for a New Economy, around projects like the Staples Center expansion or the modernization of the LAX airport, where they attach many strings to the deals to make sure that local residents in the neighborhood get first crack at the jobs, get living wages, get environmental and housing benefits, so that local people are not just roadkill for the project.
Did your book get at all into the whole issue of sports stadiums and sports arenas as supposed job development projects? Because it seems that every city in America is building a new arena, sometimes more than one, for either basketball or hockey or football or baseball.
Yes, we went after stadiums. The chapter is called Loot, Loot, Loot for the Home Team. And, you know, there's just an enormous body of evidence, quite unanimous from many different perspectives, that professional sports stadiums are not good economic development. The most they do is move dollars around. You know, you and I do not have more leisure time, and you and I do not have more money to play with just because we have a new place to go, a new stadium to go to. So really what stadiums do is just move leisure time dollars and leisure time around, but they don't create economic development. Arenas and convention centers, especially convention centers, are grossly overbuilt now. The convention center business has actually been faltering for 10 years. It began to falter long before 9/11. And despite that, cities continue to massively subsidize new convention center space, but you've basically got way too much capacity chasing fewer and fewer dollars.
How do you build a new consensus for reform?
Well, I think disclosure is the bedrock of that. Once people see who's getting the money, where it's coming from, and what we're getting in return, things change. Clawbacks, as I mentioned before, or money-back guarantee language. Job quality standards to get the poverty wage subsidy deals out of the pipeline. There's a whole system of land reforms, land use reforms, smart growth reforms we also suggest. You know, the average corporate relocation in this country is not across state lines. It's actually from a core urban area, an older area, to the fringe, often chewing up land and causing more sprawl. For instance, we document the fact that not one single state requires that job subsidies even preferentially go to, much less are mandated to go to, places that are accessible by public transportation. So low-wage families that don't own a car don't get access to many of the new jobs being subsidized by taxpayers. We think that's nuts. At least in urban areas that have good transportation systems, we should be steering those jobs to places that are accessible by public transportation to create more opportunity for low-wage families, to give more people a choice about how to get to work, to clean up the air and reduce traffic congestion.
Let me ask you, of all the examples that you came across in your research, could you give our readers an example of one of the worst in terms of the size and the ridiculousness of the kind of taxpayer subsidy?
We go into a particular kind of loophole called single sales factor. This is a sweetheart deal, especially for big manufacturing companies in a number of states. And we look at the cases, especially of Massachusetts and Illinois, both of which enacted it in the 90s. Massachusetts under the threat of losing a big manufacturing company called Raytheon, by basically rewriting the way a multi-state company determines how much of its income gets taxed in each different state. This loophole, this gimmick called single sales factor, radically reduces the amount of income tax that many companies pay in states where they're headquartered or where they have their biggest factories and warehouses. The trouble is, there's absolutely no accountability attached to it. There's no requirement that the companies create any new jobs or even retain any jobs. And what we found in cases like Illinois is that even despite the promises and projections made at the time the bill was enacted, the state has actually continued to bleed manufacturing jobs at a terrible rate. And the public coffers have lost a huge amount of money because a small number of companies have gotten enormous corporate income tax breaks. We actually reveal the fact that in many states now, the value of corporate income tax credits is so huge, it means that for new factory investments, many companies and many states pay no corporate income tax for years. Some states even allow companies now to buy and sell economic development credits to each other because they've gotten so overgrown and so irrelevant, they don't know what to do with them, so they want to trade them among each other. You talk about outrageous deals. I would also mention again the Dell deal in North Carolina. It just unfolded last winter. The company basically wanted to pay no income tax at all, and it got a package worth more than $200 million from the state, and then it played localities against each other within the state for another $37 million. So the whole package altogether may approach $300 million for a factory that the company says will cost between $100 and $115 million to build. This is a highly unusual situation where the value of the subsidy is going to actually exceed the cost of constructing the facility. That's really off the charts.
Greg LeRoy, I want to thank you very much for being with us, author of The Great American Job Scam, Corporate Tax Dodging, and the Myth of Job Creation. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Juan?
Well, activists from Pastors for Peace were stopped yesterday at the U.S.-Mexico border. They're attempting to deliver tons of humanitarian aid and hurricane relief to Cuba. The caravan is part of a long tradition of delivering shipments of humanitarian aid yearly to Latin American countries and to Cuba. The caravanistas refused to apply for a license under the U.S. embargo of Cuba as a matter of principle. They view the embargo as an immoral policy and resist complying with it.
We're joined now on the phone by Reverend Lucius Walker, who is executive director and founder of the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization, or IFCO, its parent organization of Parents for Peace. He's with the caravan in Hidalgo, Texas. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. It's good to be with you.
Reverend Walker, can you talk about the latest?
We, on yesterday, approached the border in Hidalgo to cross the bridge into Reynosa. And we were greeted not by OFAC, which is the enforcement agency we have dealt with for 14 years now, but we were greeted by enforcement officers from the U.S. Commerce Department, who informed us that no computers would be allowed to cross the border. We proceeded to test their new strategy, or at least it's an old strategy that's being used again. Remember, 400 computers had been seized in 1996, and we secured the release of those after a 94-day fast. But we tested this new resolve by sending two of our 11 vehicles, and all the computers on those vehicles were seized. Now, after that, we returned to a compound which had been provided for us by the local police, and we offloaded all of the computers onto one vehicle. The remaining vehicles without computers, but with millions of dollars worth of humanitarian aid, probably about 150 tons of aid, did cross the border between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m. Hidalgo time.
Reverend Lucius Walker, we have to leave it there, but we will certainly update our listeners and viewers on Monday on the latest situation of Pastors for Peace speaking to Reverend Walker on the border in Hidalgo, Texas. As we wrap up today, with a vigil being held today in New York to commemorate the first anniversary of the death of Palestinian human rights activist Farouk Abdelmouti. In March 2002, he began working regularly at Pacifica Radio BAI. He used his contacts to arrange interviews with with Palestinians in the occupied territories on the morning show Wake Up Call. Farouk was detained a month later, held in various jail facilities for the next 2 years, though never charged with a crime. Then a federal judge ordered he be deported, charged, or released, and so he walked out of prison on April 12, 2004. A few months later, giving a speech against detention around this country in Philadelphia, he finished his address and died apparently of a heart attack. We bring you this excerpt now. Farouk was 57 years old, an excerpt of a documentary made about Farouk Abdelmouti that was produced when he was still in prison. It begins with his son, Tarek, describing Farouk's detention.
During the time that he was arrested and taken to 26 Federal Plaza in Manhattan, this FBI agent, who's not supposed to be asking him any sorts of questions about crime or terrorism, because that's not his charge, interrogated him severely and beat him, kicked him in the groin, slapped his face, and hit his head. If it were solely for INS reasons, then that would have never happened to him.
My name is Farouk Abdelmouti. I am Palestinian. I come to this country from the 1976, and include I have a son, children was an American, born here. His name Tarek. I be detained in 26th of April after my voice was in WBI, Radio Pacifica, to bring the voice of the Palestinian people and in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and the Palestinian refugee camps.
Hundreds of thousands of people across the country heard the broadcasts, you know, broadcast from Jenin, broadcast from Nablus, all these different places where all these humanitarian disasters were taking place. People were getting, like, first-hand information of what was actually happening.
You know, I was with all these groups when we make a big rally in after 9/11, with the interfaith, I bring the Muslim speaker, I bring the Christian Arab speakers to be part of this big rally. I believe in peace, peace and justice, an equal society in the historical land of Palestine.
He always makes a distinction between legitimate national liberation struggle and terrorism. He doesn't believe in exporting the Palestinian struggle outside of its borders.
You understand about my community, the Palestinian, the Arab community here beginning to be afraid, and is afraid even to talk, afraid to go to the streets, afraid even to deal, to talk by telephones. The INS detainees, many of them, especially the 9/11 people, have families, have lawyers, have cases, and be deported. One day, a night they're deported. Never you know what time you can get move you from here. Till you move you, and after you disappear. Strange policies is working very secretly. You don't know what this can happen to you. This kind of psychological war against the Arabs and the Muslims today is the same time repeat the history of the 1943 against the Japanese Americans. We have to stop these things, you know. We have to go to talk about the balance and criterion of right and true.
Farouk Abdelmouti speaking while he was in detention for 2 years. Yesterday was the first anniversary of his death. There will be a vigil outside the federal building in New York today to remember the vigils that were held every week during his detention. That does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, John Hamilton, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scaho, Yuri Berichin, Nell Geiser, Maddie Harper, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.